Thank you. We're going to talk about our legislative agenda, both state and federal. We have our team here, including Vicki, on a whirlwind trip from D.C. to support the team in her federal role. Today's a discussion and vetting of potential issues in both arenas, both state and federal. And, you know, we want to start working informally with our delegations in both cases on whatever we're getting ready formally to put on the table. I guess one note I just want to sound, I've been trying to do this basically in every public appearance where there's a legislator in the room, to thank our state legislators for really stepping up last session. You know, our number one priority at the last session of the Oregon legislature was school funding. We had other things on the list. Some of them were accomplished, some of them weren't, but we said, above all, do this, and they really stepped up. And I think they deserve praise and thanks for doing difficult work to accomplish something that we and a lot of other people cared a lot about. So I've been trying to show our legislative delegation the love they deserve for having really stepped up in both the regular session and the special session on school funding. We have, you know, some other things to be thankful for in terms of progress. I don't think we're there yet on mental health, but they did implement a dedicated funding source for mental health with the tobacco tax, and I think we should also thank them and acknowledge that they are trying to meet this critical need as well. So in addition to always being supplicants at both levels, where we say, we really want you to do this, we want you to exercise political courage, please, 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 pass the transportation package, pass the school funding package, whatever, and at least in those two instances, in terms of school funding and mental health funding, they have risen to the occasion and deserve to be thanked for it. So,
Charlie, can I add one thing?
Please,
to that?
Yeah.
Because we also had three big lifts on housing that required a tremendous amount of collaboration. The Section 8 reform bill, which puts us in select company of states around the country. The extension of the tax credit for home ownership, skillfully handled by our team because it took an amendment to actually bring the family together to make that happen, and then a fix on a property in Old Town Chinatown. It's a little wonky, but required a lot of collaboration in the city and the county to get that done. And I don't remember a session where all of the housing priorities that we had identified were successful. So I'd like to add that to your list.
Yeah, no, I think we should go out of our way to acknowledge and thank the leadership. We've got leadership, you know, the majority leader, Diane Rosenbaum, and the speaker, Tina Kotek, from here. And we've also gotten real serious support for some of this agenda from elsewhere in the state. Martha and I have done a little bit of missionary work to try to build some of those relationships with folks elsewhere in the state, and I think we all should keep doing that as well. But we did get some good service from the last session of the legislature. Congress, well, that's another story. But we have a list, and we hope that they all get back to work soon. So with that, let me turn it over to Martha and her team, and we'll start working through the federal agenda first with Vicki Cram, who I think we all know. Nice to have you back in town briefly.
Great. Thank you, Mayor Hales and members of council. For the record, Martha Pellegrino, Director of the Office of Government Relations. Very pleased today to bring you the initial discussion drafts of both the federal and state legislative agenda. As the mayor said, we'll begin by talking about the federal issues, and then we will dig down a bit more into the state. There's basically three things we plan to do today. One is we'll provide some context for what's going on in our nation's capital and also in Salem. Then we'll walk through some of the key priority issues that are potential issues for inclusion in the agenda. And then lastly, we're obviously happy to answer any questions and would love to get your guidance as to what you want the next iteration to look like. We plan to bring the agenda is back to you in early January for final consideration. So we've got plenty of time between now and then to get these right. As the mayor said, today we have Vicki Cram, the city's representative in D.C. Also to my right is Niels Tilstrom, our senior associate of federal affairs. Just a quick word about the process of how we got to where we are on the federal side. We began soliciting items for potential inclusion in the agenda in September. We've been working closely with bureaus and offices to refine these concepts and have been in communication with other organizations, business groups, other governments about what they are considering bringing forward. I'll say a little bit more about our community involvement process when we dig into the state legislative draft. And then we always stay in regular communication with our federal congressional offices about what they're working on and what they're planning to introduce in the coming year. So at this point, I'd like to turn things over to Vicki Cram to give us a view from inside the Beltway.
Good morning. It's always a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the welcome, Mayor. I'd like to touch on the highlights of our activities over the past year and then briefly discuss some of the challenges and opportunities that will be facing us in the second session of the 113th Congress. Some of the highlights from the past year, since we last sat at this table a year ago, two of you were in your elect roles, we've taken action on every single item that was in our federal agenda for 2013. And we have expressed our position formally in letters to the delegation on a number of items and followed up on them, things such as the assault weapon ban, the need for immigration reform legislation, preserving the tax-exempt status of municipal bonds, and workforce development. Some of the legislative highlights in the past year was the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, which we were working on, the reauthorization, and the recent Senate passage of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. We are very proud to have level funding in both the House and Senate appropriations bills for veterans homeless programs, which is something we worked on very hard, the HUD-VASH program. I will leave aside the fact that those bills may not be going anywhere, but at least we got the funding in there. We got language also in the Senate Homeland Security Appropriations Bill that would allow us to be put back onto the Urban Area Security Initiative list, which was limited to 25 cities in the current fiscal year. And we also worked with the Department of Homeland Security on their methodology to raise us up a couple of bumps on that list. So we're hopeful, depending on what happens with the budget and the appropriations bills, we're hopeful we may have a case to make to get more funding, to get back on the list and get funded again. As sort of a continuation of Portland's brand as a center of innovation and best urban practices, that was pretty very, I think, elegantly exemplified by having two cabinet secretaries visit us in the last 6 months. And over the past year, we've had more than a dozen senior level administration officials, including recently the Department of Justice COPS office, who came and brought us some grant money, which is always nice. We've had a number of successful events in Portland that have included the congressional delegation, such as an example is the 11 by 13 event regarding housing preservation. Elected officials such as Mayor Hales and Commissioner Fish have been back, and city staff have journeyed to Washington, D.C. to highlight our priorities on issues as diverse as telecommunications, housing, economic development, and infrastructure. We have also worked to garner support from the delegation, who are always happy to give it to us for our grant applications, the most recent of which has been the Safer Fire Grant. We have not yet heard whether we got that or not. Challenges in the coming year. One could say Congress, but we will instead say the first big challenge is sequestration and the budget. Right now we have a conference committee that was appointed rising out of the government closure and the debt ceiling deliberations. It has very modest goals. There's going to be no grand bargain, but their modest goals are to establish a top line number for the budget and potentially stave off sequestration. And if they can't, by January 15th, another layer of cuts will come on top of the cuts that we've already experienced in our domestic discretionary budget. Another challenge is the UOC funding, which we just spoke about, trying to raise ourselves up higher through methodology and also see if we can't use Congress to be able to remove that cap of 25 cities. Moving immigration reform through the House and to conference with the Senate-passed bill, and comprehensive tax reform, which has a host of issues that are of concern to us, including the tax exemption on municipal bonds, but also renewable energy tax credits, low-income housing tax credit, private activity bonds. The Senate may be actually releasing a bill, legislative language, in the next couple of weeks, and so we'll have a better idea as to where we stand on some of these issues. While it's unlikely that tax reform will happen in the next year, we still will have to be poised to continue our advocacy for some of those many important tax provisions. Opportunities that are coming before us, continuation of our groundbreaking work on the Metropolitan Export Strategy with further linkages to the President's initiative to double the nation's exports in the next 5 years. It's actually, we're halfway through that right now. Working with the Export Council and our recent participation as one of the few cities where a number of states were represented in Select USA in Washington, D.C., regarding direct foreign investment. Promise zones pose another opportunity for us. Portland is one of a select group of eligible areas who could apply for 5 promise zone designations. It's an initiative that the President rolled out in the State of the Union at the beginning of the year. And the federal government, the idea is that the federal government will partner to invest in communities to create jobs, expand educational opportunities, and improve public safety. And it's a collaboration between the Department of Justice, the Department of Education, and Housing and Urban Development. Another round of Tiger Transportation competitive grants will likely happen in the coming year. We were successful very early on with 2, which was extraordinary. I think that sort of kicked us out of being competitive for a couple of years because they were trying to spread them around the nation. But now this would be round 6, and I think we would have an opportunity there as well. Reauthorization, of course, of MAP 21, the Surface Transportation Bill, which has a host of issues that we go into in more detail. It's one of our top priority issues in our agenda when we get to our agenda. Passage of WIFIA, which is the Water Innovative Financing Act, which would create a new low-interest program for loans for drinking water and sewer projects. So in conclusion, it's an honor to work with all of you, with the great Office of Government Relations and all your City Bureau staff who are just amazingly, this is a very collaborative process and they're amazingly engaged. And of course with our outstanding congressional delegation who really are great legislators and thought leaders in a lot of areas. And so I thought we could then move on to the actual agenda and talk about some of our high priority issues with Martha and Niels.
Thank you, Vicki. Just a quick word on structure. Draft federal agenda, we have structured in 2 ways. We've got our top line items, which are on the first page, and this will be something we'll be seeking input from council about, you know, what should these be and in what order. We currently have everything in alphabetical order for the purposes of the discussion draft. Then the rest of the agenda is structured by subject area with a number of the key bills and pieces of legislation under each of those. One note is we indicated on this draft which items are new for consideration for 2014. Otherwise, all of the items that are in there were part of the 2013 agenda and are ongoing work. Some of these things it takes several sessions to get done. And then just thematically, you know, there's several perennial issues that impact Portland. Infrastructure funding, affordable housing funding, revenue preemptions, grant opportunities, and in the budget climate that Vicki mentioned, you know, so much of what we play on the budget side is defense because it's cut, cut, cut. So we've been arming our congressional delegation with good information about if what the impacts are of the sequester or other potential budget cuts so that we can protect the programs that are important to Portlanders. So that's just a little bit of context. I think now I'm going to have turned things over to Niels to touch on the first issue in the agenda.
Good morning. The first issue that we've listed is levy recertification, and it's a new issue to the agenda. The levy system that is along the Columbia River on the north side of Portland dates back to 1916, and it's been updated. The last updates were in the 50s. FEMA requires that levees provide protection against the 1% annual chance of flood to be recognized in the National Flood Insurance Program. And if they meet these standards, then the Army Corps of Engineers deems them accredited. The impact of deaccreditation, which is a new word to me, would lead to mandatory costly flood insurance required for existing developments, would also impact and significantly change new development opportunities. It would also impact lending both on home mortgages and business loans, and putting those in jeopardy due to the risk of this deaccreditation designation. The levees in the Columbia Corridor were last accredited by FEMA in 2007. However, in 2010, the Army Corps of Engineers reassessed their guidelines for accreditation and applied new standards, ultimately invalidating many levy systems across the country, including some in our backyard, Peninsula 1 and Peninsula 2, which are the 2 sets of levees along either side of Interstate 5. So again, this doesn't just affect us, it affects many communities across the country. The window for potential review and vulnerability for the accreditation began this past August. However, there is no strict deadline that's been set for achieving the certification before FEMA would remap the area and deem the areas beyond the levees outside of the National Flood Insurance Program. This project has been designated an Oregon Solutions Project by Governor Kitzhaber. The items that had been identified by the Bureau of Environmental Services for this priority had been potential timeline extension that allows for regulatory alignment between the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA, since they're not currently aligned, and also identify federal funds to help offset these large-scale projects with possible incentives for local, state, and private contributions to the process.
So maybe just a little more illumination here would help me anyway, between you and Commissioner Fish, and that is, what is it that we have to do locally over the next couple of years in terms of technical work to support the recertification?
That's a good question. I think that there have been meetings with stakeholders, both public and private, the lead actually in this process has been Multnomah County Drainage District,
right.
Reed Wagner. So I, to a certain extent, I'd have to sort of turn that question over to BES staff and maybe Commissioner Fisher.
Well, one of the concerns, Mayor, is that currently the drainage districts are in the front lines of dealing with this. But if the federal requirements become so onerous, there is a potential, not only here but nationally, of drainage districts literally dissolving in order to get out from under a financial obligation that they and their ratepayers can't meet. If that happens, my understanding, Vicki, is that then the liabilities might pass largely through to the city or the county. And so we are directly and indirectly impacted by this. And so there's the crafting of the regulations around the recertification, but there's also working with these drainage districts. I think this is, for us, Charlie, almost a companion piece with Superfund because of the potential liability of the community.
And I'll just add that along with the Bureau of Environmental Services, Portland Parks and Recreation has been at the table and has an interest too. And so what will happen, we'll continue to be talking with the drainage district and our bureaus. So when we bring this back to you, we will have some concrete asks for the delegation because it is very likely we'll need their help on this on a number of fronts in order to protect property owners and risks that we have. So
is it fair to say that what we need in both cases, both Superfund and this, is we need regulatory clarity and funding? I mean, we don't get any funding at the moment with Superfund designation. When we get to that, we'll talk about that. But I think it's reasonable for us to put that on the table.
I would say yes on both, and then we need to play a little defense on changing the rules around municipal finance, because one of the double whammy could be that the Congress, Senate decides to change those rules, which will significantly increase the cost of borrowing for us at a time when we might have new exposure. So we have to keep our eye on both.
Good, thank you.
Next item is maintaining the alternative compliance options on LT2, long-term 2 enhanced surface water treatment rule. And this is essentially sort of protecting and maintaining the variance where the city was the first in the country to receive a variance, in this case from the state of Oregon. So given the rulemaking going on at EPA, we're going to carefully monitor the EPA rulemaking process and make sure that there aren't changes that would endanger the variance. After that, next item that's been mentioned already is protecting the tax-exempt status of municipal bonds.
Before you move on.
Sure.
I think we also are seeking some changes in the LT2 rule so that it would actually be easier for us. Maybe we wouldn't have to keep doing our variance. So I think there's a nuance there that we might want to discuss more. I'm sure we'll get public testimony on it.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. So the municipal bonds tax interest exemption, the reason that we're including as a top line item is both the administration and the Senate have already almost conceded on this issue, meaning there is a proposal to cap the amount of tax deductibility of municipal bonds at 28%. We had the Office of Management and Finance run some numbers about what that means, and it, in very simple terms, it means that all of the infrastructure Portland will build will become more expensive. Not just the city, but every single government, transit agencies, the county, if you're building something, the cost of borrowing will go up. So our national partners in the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the National League of Cities, and frankly, every other national organization that works with cities, this is a top priority. Because in the time where federal funding becomes more scarce, Congress making a move to change the tax exempt status of municipal bonds makes it harder for this council and other governments to plan the needed infrastructure replacements. Vicki, do you want to take that one?
Well, it generates revenue, and that's why it's being proposed. So the president proposed it twice in his budget, this in FY12 and FY13, and then the Senate budget included that in their budget proposal. So it would be done through, with being in a budget doesn't mean anything other than for the fact that it's in the budget, but it's not actually law. It would have to happen through comprehensive tax reform and go through the Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee, and we have yet to see where they are on this issue, but the fact that it's already out there and on the table is significant.
Vicki, when you and I were in D.C., we got a briefing from Senator Wyden's tax counsel. Of course, Senator Wyden is widely believed to be switching committees at some point in the future, where he will have a big say over this. And one of the things that we were told was there is a perception, apparently, that this particular tax preference is skewed to wealthy individuals who take advantage of it. And I think our reaction in that conversation was, if the public benefit has been clearly established, why is that our why would that be the concern in terms of changing it? Or if you have a better idea, for we're not getting direct assistance sequestration, we're getting fewer dollars. There's no fund in Superfund. There's no other kinds of funding available. This is now a tool that we rely on to keep our costs of borrowing down when we are at the local level required to pick up costs that once upon a time there was more federal sharing of those costs. And now you're talking about a reform measure which will increase our costs. So I think the thing we pushed back on was perhaps there's another way to structure this where the cities and localities get the benefit of having cheaper borrowing without it being done through municipal tax exemption on municipal bonds. But we thought it was peculiar to couch it in terms of it being skewed to wealthy individuals who take advantage of this, since the benefit is so clear to the rest of us.
And besides that, of course, every tax deduction in a progressive tax system is skewed to wealthy individuals. And I would like it if they take up things like the hedge fund loophole before they started hammering infrastructure. And also, I just can't resist saying that if they're talking about using this as a tool to raise revenue, it reflects the obsession with the financial deficit as opposed to with the infrastructure deficit, which I would have hoped is fairly well documented.
Great. Next item is a cleanup of the Portland Harbor Superfund. This has also been a top-line item for the city for the last few years. The thing about this year that may be a little bit different is I think there's widespread recognition that Region 10 EPA is completely under-resourced to do the reviews that they need to do to complete them on time. And so what's being proposed is a request of the delegation to see if we can get some additional people and experts from EPA and DC to be temporarily reassigned to complete the review so that we can get started on the cleanup of the Superfund site.
Martha, I'm sorry.
Sure. Maybe, again, supplementing the language that we have here now with actually requesting that Congress refund the Superfund program. Terribly courageous about funding mandates these days, but they'll be even less so if we don't ask. So.
Specifically, and I know the Congressman Blumenauer has made this a cause in the past, restoring the tax on oil and chemical companies, which was repealed by Newt Gingrich in 1995, were allowed to lapse, which used to pay for some Superfund activities.
Right.
And I should add that the lapse of the tax on Gesundheit, Commissioner, the oil industry in particular gets away with murder when it comes to Superfund because there's something called the petroleum exclusion, which means that to the extent the petroleum products contribute to Superfund sites, they're not on the hook for site-specific costs. And the fact that there used to be a tax on oil as well as chemical companies that used to help fund the Superfund meant that they paid for some Superfund work through that means. But now the oil industry pays nothing because there's a petroleum exclusion that applies to site-specific liability, and there's no tax.
We have a stake in that, given our situation, the kind of contamination.
I actually don't know, but I think that we have a stake in Superfund being funded, and it used to be that there was money for Region 10 and all the other regions in the country and for site-specific work that came from the oil and chemical industry tax. As to whether there's, I actually don't know in Portland Harbor whether, it's largely PCBs. I don't know how much of it comes from the oil industry.
Well, you may want to look into that some more. It sounds like there's a sense here that we ought to be more aggressive and more specific about
what we're asking our congressional delegation to take up on Superfund. There ought to be revenue and expenditure on the federal side. There ought to be, if there are exclusions or exemptions that are preventing potentially responsible parties from bearing their responsibility, then we care about that. As we step into this issue, it's going to be hard enough, but if people are carved out as exempt, that isn't going to help.
I think the simplest thing to do is just to support what Earl has proposed in the past, which is restoring the tax that did exist until 1995.
Yeah. Okay.
Great. Niels, do you want to touch on the last item?
Absolutely. The last item we have in our federal priorities, top line items, is the reauthorization of the Moving Ahead for Progress and the 21st Century Act, which is MAP 21, the Federal Surface Transportation Reauthorization. This was a two-year bill. Typically, highway bills are, or surface transportation bills, rather, are six-year bills. And so we had identified four main items under this issue to go after. One is that the city will advocate for sustainable sources of revenue to provide for stable funding for investment in transportation infrastructure and transit services. The second, that the city supports the authorization of the Transportation Investment Regenerating Economic Recovery, which is the TIGER grant program, and also asked for increased competition and funding for that program. The third item, which was support amending MAP 21 to allow for direct allocations of funding to metropolitan planning organizations, so MPOs, so more funding that would go towards cities rather than be going through the states. And getting a better chance of a bite at that. The last item was amending MAP 21 to restore flexibility in funding for transit and alternative modes of transportation. MAP 21 was largely a policy bill with not a lot of funding attached to it, and one of the things that it did was squeeze a lot of the alternative transportation programs into one program and then making that harder for us to do the things that we've been doing for decades. So.
Nils, I know that you and Katie Triver in my office have been going back and forth about whether it might make sense, and if so, how, to add some language suggesting that MAP 21 be amended to reflect that the federal government should consider the health impacts of transportation investments in determining which projects to fund, because there's a growing body of research that shows that investments in not just active transportation but also transit, which promotes walking, has positive health impacts. And I'm wondering if you could, do you think that there's any way we can logically fit that concept into our federal agenda?
I think so. I think in items, sorry that are not numbered here, but the TIGER item and then the last item, which was transit and alternative modes, I think you can argue that health impacts as a requirement for those competitive funds would make sense.
Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. The other one, and I mentioned this to to Martha earlier, we ought to work with Congressman Blumenauer on language to reflect this, but with only one exception, that being our streetcar project on the east side, all the streetcar projects in the country that have gotten federal funds have gotten them through Tiger or through urban circulator grants, by, in other words, going around the federal FTA project development process. One way or another, we want, you know, this administration to have a tool that we can compete for. It's going to be a competitive grant, whether it's Tiger or Urban Circulator Grant, or call it FRED, call it whatever you want. But it isn't going to be new starts or small starts because it's too convoluted and difficult to get through it. So I don't, the details we can work on before we flesh this out, and Earl will guide us, but I think we ought to be on record. And I think actually that might add a particular note of credibility, in that we are the only city that soldiered all the way through the small starts process and got funding. And for us to say, no thanks, you know, you're going to need something that's more flexible and accessible for projects that want to get funded. So it's something that, you know, we need to hear more from the new Secretary of Transportation about what he thinks. Ray LaHood was just a lion about this, about actually finding a way to get the money out the door to real projects rather than getting caught in the bureaucracy. So it's one where we can be guided by Congressman Blumenauer's expertise on the issue, and he's also interested in making this work. So I think we ought to include that in our transportation package.
Mayor, I just want to acknowledge that later on in our agenda we have something, a program called COPS and HOME, and we have these acronyms, SAFE, these acronyms that actually relate to the subject matter. And I want to tip my hat to the transportation world for having the most obscure jargon and incomprehensible
ICE-T,
acronyms.
Yeah,
MAP-21, Tiger, Ice-T, and MPO. And they just scream transportation when you think of them.
Yeah,
but
right.
I don't know who came up with these. But Vicky earns her keep just keeping those straight when she walks us around the halls of Washington.
We do use that for transportation.
Yeah, that's at least some relationship.
So before we move from the federal priorities, there's two that I think we should add. One actually is moving from the next page, which is the Community Parks Revitalization Act. It's well documented how our infrastructure and transportation is underfunded. I think what's less well known in Portland is that parks is equally or more underfunded. So I think any assistance that we could get from the federal government would be helpful. And then secondly, in light of the mayor's comments on education funding at the state level, I think adding that to our federal priorities, particularly if we get to sequestration, and my hope that education, Head Start, and food stamps would be protected over military spending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
I see SNAP is in there.
That was one of the scary things of sequestration, what we just went through with the government shutdown, was that we were okay until the end of the month, and that's when the Head Start grants would start falling off and the food stamps even more so. Mm-hmm. I think people, unless they were federal employees, didn't necessarily feel the effect of those cuts, but we certainly would ongoing.
Good. I like that. Anything else on the rest of the federal list that we ought to at least touch on? There are a couple other new items in there, aren't there? Pipeline safety is in there. You want me to go all the way through that?
I mean, it's sort of up to what the council would like to do. We don't have to march through any of these items, but certainly if there are questions on anything else on the list, I'm happy to discuss those.
Well, these are all standing policies, right, with the exception of the new ones.
That's correct.
So I guess my thought would be you ought to touch on the new ones and why they're here. SAFE Act, pipeline safety, whichever ones on there are new, and then maybe members of the council that have other comments or suggestions, or want, as Commissioner Fritz just did, to loft something from the B list to the A list. That makes sense to everybody? So why don't you touch on the new ones first?
Great.
Niels,
why don't you kick us off on brownfields?
Sorry about that. The Brownfields Utilization and Investment in Local Development Act, the BUILD Act, which is actually the reauthorization of the Brownfields Program, EPA, and it's a bill that had been introduced and it has not been scheduled for hearing or markup or hearing yet, and this gives us an opportunity to weigh in with our delegation on our priorities of the brownfields. This, you know, the way that these are written are very sort of one sentence descriptions, and we can work on what our priorities are and to help illustrate to the delegation what the city needs out of a new brownfields program.
And of course, with the ongoing conversation about industrial land and trade-offs and things on our agenda, all the more important that we're taking full advantage of the opportunity to transform brownfields into productive space for jobs.
Help me out on this one, because this is a great acronym, but I don't know what the Build Act does.
It is the reauthorization. The brownfields program is nearing the end of its authorization timeline, and so this is a chance for Congress to revisit the program, to make any technical changes, policy changes, funding allocations that they want to do.
So we've been successful, Mayor, in the past, actually getting federal grants towards the brownfield revitalization.
Mm-hmm. So this is the authorization for that grant authority at EPA.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Sorry. The next item we have is the Farm Bill. We have a new section this year for the Farm Bill, and the first item in that section is SNAP, which is a Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And so the item we have listed here is opposition to the cuts in the SNAP program. There, as the Farm Bill moves through a conference committee, there are two levels of cuts. One proposed by the House, which is I believe it's $39 billion.
$39 billion over
four years. And the Senate much lower, I think.
$4 billion.
So that difference is quite significant.
Nils?
Yes.
I think I actually suggested this item, and it occurs to me opposes cuts, given where we are now, might not go far enough. I mean, really, I was hoping to restore funding to what probably would have been FY 2012-2013 levels or whatever they were before 2 months ago.
The next item under Farm Bill is fresh fruits and vegetables, and this is a new item. The city supports food policy reforms to create parity for subsidies to healthy fruits and vegetables at the same level as other types of food. And this is an item that Commissioner Novick had generated.
Is this domestically grown?
Yes, is my understanding. This is a model. The model is actually created by and advocated for by Congressman Blumenauer.
I'd like that to be specifically stated in the
absolutely
policy. Thanks.
And we have healthcare emergency services reimbursement. Currently, Portland Fire and Rescue emergency responses, a significant number of them are related to calls for service related to medical issues. In addition, Portland is exploring a model implemented in other cities that includes a nurse or other health professionals at 911 to triage some calls for emergency medical services, reducing medical costs for the public and insurers. With this in mind, the city supports federal efforts to add healthcare reimbursement models that acknowledge the role of fire departments and 911 centers in providing medical services.
Now, this again is something that I suggested. I mean, we've had conversations with Commissioner Saltzman about the fact that both BOEC and fire are part of the medical system, but we never get paid by medical insurance, including Medicare, for what we do. Meanwhile, the ambulances do get paid, but historically only for taking people to emergency rooms. And we've had some conversations with some health providers and insurers about the idea of creating a more rational system where all insurers, including the federal government, reimburse entities that are part of the healthcare system and reimburse them in a more rational way.
Steve, the promise of healthcare reform is it'll free up some money for some other complementary investments. And we've talked in the past about hoping to get some money for housing as part of the peace dividend, if you will, for healthcare reform. Does this approach compete with those dollars, or is it complementary?
Actually, I don't think it competes at all, because I think that ultimately making the kind of changes we're talking about here would save the federal government money in terms of unnecessary emergency room care, et cetera. But I at least would have no problem with adding something to the agenda saying that the federal government should consider investments in housing to be a permissible use of Medicaid dollars, and maybe Medicare as well.
Do we need that, or is that something we have flexibility at the local level?
I think that the states still need, I think New York has actually asked for a waiver in order to make those investments, so I don't think it's something we automatically have the ability to do at the local level. I think we still have to ask federal.
Could we flag this, Martha, for you to look at? Because this is the idea that if there were some dollars freed up to actually put people into homes and provide some services, viewing that as a more cost-effective approach than just having people on the street using emergency room services, is there the flexibility under Medicare in the future for us to do that? It's a live discussion locally in terms of our health care reform. Be interesting to know whether having a federal placeholder on that would be helpful.
Sure, happy to look into that.
The next item in healthcare that is new is the Affordable Care Act's affordable coverage definition. I'm going to give you the one sentence description on this, and it's to support changes in the IRS interpretation of the definition of affordable in the Affordable Care Act, which provides a hurdle to attain coverage for families through their employer, and it's referred to as the family glitch. And I know that Commissioner Novick is going to want to.
Yeah, this is one of the actual flaws of the Affordable Care Act, or at least the interpretation of it by the IRS, as opposed to the mythical flaws in the Affordable Care Act. The IRS has interpreted the Affordable Care Act as saying that if an employer offers coverage to individual employees, which is affordable, meaning is available at less than X percent of family income, then if the employer also offers family coverage, then that coverage is considered affordable no matter what it costs. So, for example, if an employer offers $400 a month health insurance to its employee and $16,000 a month health insurance to the employee's family, then the $16,000 a month is considered, quote, affordable. This means that there are families that are going, in places where they can go online, are going online now and thinking that, spouse one has insurance through the employer, but the employer family coverage is unaffordable, so presumably we can get some tax credits in order to get insurance through the exchange, and they're finding out that they can't. Actually, when I was at the Oregon Health Authority, we didn't think that this was a necessary interpretation of the act. We thought that the IRS was actually misreading it, and they could have read it a different way. But this is the way they're reading it, and it is a problem which I doubt this Congress would be, at least one house of this Congress would be inclined to fix, but it'd be nice if they did.
On page 5, we
have... Before you move on from healthcare, I have a couple of additions. One is to encourage coverage of the behavioral therapy for autism that we got passed at this local and now at the state level. So it'd be great to have that at the national level. And then secondly, advocating for nationwide protected sick time.
And also, Vicki, in light of our continuing interest to secure a sustainable community grant, and in light of the fact that that is the HUD Secretary's sort of showcase legacy project, could we add that to our housing agenda so that we are supporting continued funding? It's funded at a very modest level, but it is our sincere hope as a region that we are successful someday to get that grant to look at housing affordability on a regional basis. I think it would be well received if we were advocating for retaining what is a HUD priority program.
Absolutely.
That we hope someday to successfully compete for.
And Commissioner Fritz just wanted to point out that the support federal paid sick leave is on page 6.
It is here.
The very end of the second to last.
Oh, there it is.
It's under workforce.
And that's good. We were partly
successful because we framed it as a healthcare issue rather than a workforce issue. Obviously, it's both.
Yes, we can certainly.
Thank you very much. Thank you. The more places it's in, the better.
On page 4 in parks, we have support for the Land and Water Conservation Fund. This is a long-standing program which provides matching grants to states and local governments for the acquisition and development of public outdoor recreation areas. Above that, I apologize, is the Strengthen and Fortify Enforcement Act, the SAFE Act, under immigration reform. This is a bill that has been floated in the House and could potentially be one of the piecemeal items that is voted on. The House and the Senate are, the Senate had passed a comprehensive bill. The House is looking at passing individual bills, and this stands as one of them that the House may take up. This bill would require local law enforcement agencies to ask immigration status at point of maybe pulling someone over, taking somebody into custody, and that would link that a practice to the eligibility for a community policing funding, COPS program. So that is something that is, you know, could potentially, is definitely a problematic, you know, potentially problematic.
Okay.
And under the comprehensive immigration reform, we didn't pass the DREAM Act yet at the national level, right? So could we specifically call out the DREAM Act, please?
Under public safety and safety communications infrastructure, we have pipeline safety, and the one-sentence description on that is, the city will work with the delegation to highlight the need for oversight of gas and liquid fuel pipelines and tanks for safety and seismic preparedness.
I just wanted to add maybe some words to the Burn JAG grant, Justice Assistance Grant. We have used those grants in the past to also assist in combating human trafficking. And so I just think it'd be nice to put that in there as well.
Perfect, thank you. On page 5, we have the Gang Resistance Education and Training Program, the GREAT program. And it is expressing support for this program, which is a school-based gang and violence prevention program designed to teach youths to avoid gang membership, prevent violence and criminal activity, and assist youth in developing positive relationships with law enforcement. And then I believe the item on page 6, which is new, which is support the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would prohibit discrimination in the workplace based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And that bill passed the Senate recently. It's moved over to the House.
Just a comment on that. On Saturday night, I went to a friend's house, and Senators Wyden and Merkley were there, and they were joined by a senator who is third in line for the presidency. Steve Novick, who is that? The most senior member of the Senate, who came with full presidential security detail, whose wife's brother is teaches at the UP. Patrick Leahy.
Leahy is dad.
He is President pro tem or something, right. He is third in line, and he has, therefore, president. He has security. So no one could park at the house. We had to park at a church down the road. And the point I wanted to make, though, was that Senator Leahy told the story of the handoff from Senator Kennedy to Senator Merkley to the passage in the Senate of ENDA. And he called out something which he said too rarely happens in our legislative lives, which was Senator Merkley walking into the Republican cloakroom and rounding up the votes that he needed and making the deal that allowed him to overcome a filibuster and move it forward. And it was downright, he was very eloquent about it, and I can't tell you how proud the folks in that House were hearing that our junior senator had done something great. And the reason I've suggested we include this is that its fate in the House is anything but certain. So it seemed appropriate for us to get behind that to support not only Jeff, but Portland values and make this part of our agenda.
Good. There's something else I'd like to add to this category.
Thank you, Commissioner. To this category, which is to support the Employee Free Choice Act and impose meaningful penalties on employers who fire people for trying to organize in unions. This is something that was a priority a few I mean, I think of all of our delegation a few years ago, and its prospects in the current House, I would assume, are minimal. But I think it's pretty well documented that one of the major factors in the spectacular increase in economic inequality in the past 30 years has been the decline of unions, which can be largely attributed to the fact that there's virtually no protection in American labor law for people to try to organize. Around the 1970s, employers realized that they could simply fire people for trying to organize, and the penalties are extremely minimal. You might pay back pay if somebody gets their job back in a few years. And I was stunned when I learned this some years ago, and I was enforcing the environmental laws where if you violate the Clean Air Act, for example, you can pay up to $25,000 per day per violation. So the idea that we have pretty stiff penalties for violating the environmental laws but not basic labor rights, I think, is still offensive.
I guess I would like to add under this category or raise for the possibility of inclusion. I mean, we saw tremendous support in our Oregon Values and Beliefs survey for workforce training and reinvestment. So I'm thinking there must be something that perhaps Portland Community College or community colleges, plus our high schools. I mean, there's a growing concern that our high schools need to play a greater role or sort of restore a role in workforce training. So I'm wondering if there's something in that realm that we could also sort of add our two cents of support with.
Absolutely, and we did send a letter this year on that very subject. So it's part of our agenda, and we would carry that over, yes.
Okay, other suggestions for additions, augmentation of the agenda that we've got? Again, we've walked through all the new items. Everything else is standing policy, but this is good discussion, good additions to the list here.
I jumped over something related to transportation, which wouldn't really be part of the legislative agenda, but it's something that I've asked Vicki to continue talking to the delegation and to the Federal Department of Transportation about, which is it would be nice if they did some research into the possibility of building double-axle buses for urban transportation. Buses, much as we love them, impose a lot of wear and tear on the roads, and the PBOT chief engineer, Steve Townsend, has said that if somebody could figure out a way to build double-axle buses, that could save us between $4 and $8 million a year in wear and tear on the roads. And I've mentioned that as something to explore to Polly Trottenberg at USDOT, and she said she'd take a look at it. I'd love to see if we could follow that up.
Good.
And going back to some of the previous priorities on page 2, the coal exports piece, I'd like to work with you on refining that paragraph because it doesn't really say anything. I mean, it just states the problem, but not what we're going to advocate for. So if we can look back to the resolution we passed and make it stronger, I'd appreciate that. Thanks.
Sure, happy to do that. And this, as the discussion draft, there's certainly a lot we left out, but we would very much like to work with you and each member of council on make sure that before we bring the next draft back, it really adequately reflects the values of this council. So we'd be delighted to work with you on that.
On climate change, I was just going to sort of toss out a concept and see if there's any appetite for pursuing it. I mean, Americans contribute to global warming significantly by purchasing products that are made in other countries with very carbon-intensive energy regimes. And I mean, ideally, it seems to be we would have an international system of tariffs where the import fees on products vary according to the carbon intensity with which they were produced. Now, I would imagine that implementing such a regime would probably involve changing all sorts of international rules. But I think that, I mean, talking about specific things like the Keystone Pipeline, et cetera, is important, but also something of a game of whack-a-mole, because if we're still importing products that are made in China through their, you know, increasing their coal production, we still have the problem. So is that something that people might be interested in exploring? IBEW nationally had some concept like this some years ago.
And Commissioner, the administration has just come out with a new climate change mitigation policy. Seeking input for climate change mitigation policy, and there's a state and local committee that has been assembled, and they will be taking recommendations on different aspects of climate change, and perhaps we can work with you to see if we can't make some recommendations to them.
So before we close the federal section, I see Paul is here. I'm not sure whether you're talking about state or federal support for the public market. But, sorry.
But where does that fall on our agenda at this point?
Sure. Mr. Paul and I had an opportunity to talk a little bit about where the next phase of funding for the James Beard Public Market is. They had a successful run at the state legislature this last session and received an appropriation of $250,000 to continue their the planning phases.
Is that because of Jennifer?
Representative Williamson led the charge on that.
Yeah.
Vicki has worked in many previous federal agendas to secure successfully secure funding. I think if council wishes to do so, I suggest we add that to our federal list to continue to explore potential sources of funding where the that could be a good fit for the market. You know, we're in this challenging environment where project-specific funding is very difficult because we're in a still in an earmark ban. Having said that, there have been successes working with some of the agencies, and there are potentially competitive grants. So my suggestion is that council consider adding it to our line of priorities under the federal sort of policy positions and federal priority section, and that we continue to work with Ron and others to see if there are any potential eligible federal funding sources to support the market.
Well, thanks to his good work and also Representative Williams and others, you know, the project's really got momentum now. So mm-hmm. I think if there is a chance for federal funding in addition to getting further help from the state, you know, we should certainly be on it. So.
I know you didn't bring the earmark list forward, but you could add it to that as well.
Such as it might
be. But I think that allows us, as the mayor just said, to be opportunistic if there is a special grant program or whatever. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that Congressman Blumenauer will be scouring the budget for something that he can support. So,
yeah, good. Let's get us on record. Back your play. Good. Anything else on the federal list? So you'll make those revisions, mm-hmm. and then we'll take that public.
Great.
All right. Let's move on to the state.
Thank you.